We're back with the first full show of 2017. And yes, I almost said 2016 the first time I said that. You're listening to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Coming up in today's show, we'll hear from arts reporter Sarah Hauer with the latest on the prestigious Knoll Fellowship winners. We'll also hear from political reporter Patrick Marley in Madison. Patrick joins us to chat about the Republican strength in the legislature and what that means moving forward. Up first, an apartment building is going up in downtown Milwaukee on the booming east side. So what's new and different about that? Well, this one does have one difference. Folks who rent these apartments will find them much more affordable than other ones going up nearby. Business reporter Tom Dakin, who specializes in real estate and development, talks about the Greenwich Park Apartments project with fellow reporter Tom Content.
Hi, this is Tom Content from the Journal Sentinel Business Section. I'm here with Tom Dakin again from our business section who covers real estate for us. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So you write a lot about new developments in the downtown area and Milwaukee and apartments, but you have something a little different this time. What do you have up your sleeve?
Well, a little different. It's an apartment building. It's on the east side of Milwaukee. It's in an area where other new apartment buildings, nice new apartment buildings have been built in the last couple of years. Looks like those buildings, but there's a crucial difference, and that difference is this building, known as Greenwich Park, was financed in part with federal affordable housing tax credits. And what that means is that the developer, in return for getting those credits, has to set aside most of those apartments for people who are earning no more than 60% of the local median income. And those apartments that are then provided to those folks at below market rents. So this building isn't really aimed at poor people per se. I know this is all kind of a matter of judgment. It's really aimed at more moderate income people who perhaps otherwise couldn't afford these apartments. And that's what makes it different. It's unusual for that neighborhood. We have other apartment developments like this in our area, both in Milwaukee and in the suburbs, but not typically on the east side of Milwaukee.
Why do the developers want to use this financing here?
Well, the developer in this case is called Mercy Housing Lakefront. They're based out of Chicago, and they specialize in doing these type of apartment developments. They've done others in the Milwaukee area, more in central city locations. I guess the rationale for it from the perspective of the policymakers who approved it, and that'd be the Common Council and Mayor Tom Barrett, is that you do sometimes have people who want to live in affluent areas or relatively affluent areas like the east side who can't afford the rent there. And in this case, the argument for it would be this helps provide kind of the economic and the racial integration that people say we need for Milwaukee to be a better community. And that's what you're getting with Greenwich Park. 53 apartments, about two-thirds of those are set aside at the below-market rents.
So 53 apartments, how big of a building?
Five stories, which is pretty typical, again, of some of the newer buildings that are being built over in and around that area. If you think of roughly near North Avenue from about Prospect down to Oakland, there have been three buildings built, and another one is coming since 2014. This is the only one of those that has the affordable apartments. So as a result, if you qualified for the income, you could get, for example, you could get a two-bedroom unit there for about roughly, let's say, around $800.
Okay. How does that compare?
Well, if you were going to get that same apartment at market rate, you'd probably be paying about $1,400.
Okay.
So you're saving several hundred dollars by virtue of qualifying. But again, in that particular case, we're talking about a household that's earning at no more than 50% of the median income.
Okay.
So, but again, a lot of these will be rented in all likelihood to people who work nearby at Columbia St. Mary's, to people who work at Prospect Medical Commons. Obviously, not the doctors, but maybe medical technicians or medical file clerks or people who work in the billing department, people
sure,
like that
sure.
who, you know, are arguably what we used to quaintly refer to as middle class.
Right. And you expect more of these developments?
Well, every year the federal government, and it's been doing this since the Reagan administration, that's when this program was created, every year the federal government allocates these tax credits to the states. The states, in turn, set up a competition. Developers compete for them, and usually in April, our Wisconsin Housing Economic Development Authority announces who received the credits. So, yeah, we'll get another batch of these developments next spring, or this spring, I should say, and probably some will be in Milwaukee and some will be in other communities throughout the state.
Great. Well, thanks for letting us know, Tom.
You bet.
Check out Tom's article in Sunday's business section, in print and online at jsonline.com. Rose Curley and Brooke Seal are using their Knoll Fellowships to explore the complex topic of transracial adoption. Arts reporter Sarah Hauer talked to the artists about their work. Sarah joins producer Aaron Coy with the latest.
I'm here with Sarah Hauer, who wrote a story about two of this year's Knoll Fellowship winners. So, Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about what the Knoll Fellowship is?
Yeah, so the Knoll Fellowship is one of the most prestigious art fellowships in southeastern Wisconsin. It's in memory of Mary Knoll, and so each year what they do is they award five artists a grant, and so there's two established artists who receive a larger sum, and then they name three emerging artists who receive $10,000, no strings attached, and then they can work on their art project. They have some money in the bank, and then they'll be able to show their work at the Knoll Fellowship show, which will be in late spring.
Two of the three emerging artists this year are Brooke and Rose, who you talked to. Can you tell us a little bit about their adoption stories before we get into their work?
Yeah, so when we were going through the list of who won the Knoll Fellowship, it kind of stuck out to me and my editor that there were two women both exploring their transracial adoptions, which it's not extremely rare to be transracially adopted. I would think most people listening know someone or have come in contact with people who have been transracially adopted. But for two of the people winning this prestigious fellowship to both be working on that type of project is a little different. And the two women who are working on these projects also have very different adoption stories. Brooke was born in Korea, adopted by a white family in Green Bay when she was 9 months old and grew up there. She now lives in Milwaukee. And then Rose was born in Milwaukee. She's biracial and was adopted by a white family and grew up here in Milwaukee.
So both of these women are working on transracial-centric projects. How do their projects differ a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Brooke and Rose are very different artists. Brooke would describe herself as an animator. She works mostly that way and with film. And for the Knoll Fellowship, she's creating these really cool traditional Korean dresses. And these big hanbok dresses, they kind of look like bells, is how I would probably describe them. And what she's doing that's cool beyond just creating these dresses is that she's going to use that animation skill. And so along the bottom of the dress, she's going to create kind of a flip book, is the best way for me to describe it. So she's going to have a series of images along the bottom of the dress. She's creating a couple of these. And then she's going to put them on dress forms and have them spin with a strobe light. And so then when the dress spins with the strobe light, you'll be able to see along the bottom this story emerge. And so she's still toying around with exactly what she wants to get across and what materials she's going to use, because each one of the dresses, she kind of wants to reflect a different stage of what she's thought about her adoption throughout her life. And so she was telling me about one photo of her just in this, I think it was a rhinestone t-shirt and this denim hat and this denim rhinestone something. And so she's thinking she might make one of the dresses out of denim. The other thing that she's hoping to do either at the Knoll show or just in another project, she's learning to sing in the pansori style, which is a traditional Korean folk singing. And she wants to sing in the pansori style, but in English, her adoption story, but then use the dresses to kind of say what she's not singing. Yeah, so she has kind of a lot going on. She's done a bunch of different cool stuff in her time. She also did this one show a few years ago where she made all of these super beautiful, elaborate cakes. She actually has a degree in cake decorating. She is one of those people you cannot try to put in a box, right? She, you know, first of all, she's born in Korea. She grows up in Green Bay. She's the youngest of these three brothers. All her brothers are doctors. She's an artist. She hunts deer with her brothers, but she also bakes these cakes. She was in the roller derby.
She was in the roller derby, like the Milwaukee roller
derby? The Milwaukee roller derby, yeah.
Yay. That's awesome.
So, very interesting woman. So I'm really excited to see what she pulls together for the show and how she tells her adoption story. The other fellow who I talked with who's working on this similar type of project is Rose Curley. And so Rose is working on a graphic memoir about her adoption story. And so she started her project while she was in graduate school. She just graduated from the Art Institute of Chicago with her master's. She went to undergrad at Rhode Island School of Design. And so she's working on this graphic memoir that has multiple storylines going on in it because there's her at different points in her life. In one screen of the graphic memoir, you'll see, you know, her as a child, her as a young adult, and her in the present. So the impetus for her starting the book, or like the storyline, starts with her going up to her cabin and making this conscious decision to learn about race in our society and how the history of her circumstances and the history of white families adopting black children in the United States hasn't always been accepted, and how that played into her own life experiences and realizing in hindsight some of the things that she experienced growing up were probably racist and not necessarily just something that happens to all kids.
Okay, you mentioned a little bit about the circumstances and trials of transracial adoption. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found out?
Yeah, so transracial adoption kind of started with these Korean children who didn't have families and they needed a home. For the longest time, Korea was the largest sender of children, if you want to phrase it that way, to other countries to be adopted. And so it was viewed as this humanitarian effort, and a lot of people viewed the children who were adopted transnationally, transracially, as like these recipients of charity. And there's really much less controversy about people adopting Korean or most Asian children. Domestically, adopting the adoption of black children by white families has been kind of streaked with controversy. It hasn't always been in the realm of acceptable at different times. I want to say it was the Black Social Workers Society came out with a paper saying that it didn't think transracial adoption was a good idea. It thought that it was bad for the children and bad for the families. Just because growing up with a parent who doesn't look like you, they might not understand some of the issues you may face going forward, even as compassionate and as much as you want to understand. If you haven't had that experience, you might not know how to raise a child who's going through that experience. And there's been various government involvement in sanctioning and not of transracial adoption. So the two circumstances are very different.
Sarah's story already ran in the Journal Sentinel. If you'd like to read it, you can find it online at tapmilwaukee.com. Republicans in the state legislature are taking charge of a new session with a strength of numbers they haven't seen in decades. What will they do? Patrick Marley answers that question. Here's Patrick and opinions editor Dave Haynes.
And I'm joined by Patrick Marley. Patrick is a State House reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Patrick, earlier this week, your colleague in Madison, Jason Stein, wrote that, let me get the quote right here, that The conservative agenda was on a full gallop. The Republicans have the biggest sort of margins they've had in the legislature in nearly 50 years. So what's on that conservative agenda?
And that's, you know, Republicans have controlled Wisconsin for 6 years now. What they're getting now is a Republican president as well. And so some things that they've been stymied on in the past, they feel like they can finally make some traction with. So a good example of that would be drug testing for people with public benefits. That's something they've passed, but they haven't gotten federal approval for to do as fully as they would like. This, they're hoping, will give them room to do something like that.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other issues where, with Republicans in control of the White House and Congress, that there might be more of an opening for Republicans here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. They can, I mean, if the Trump administration moves forward with this block granting of Medicaid, Medicaid is a program we call it Badger Care here, where the elderly and the poor get public assistance for health care. That comes with a lot of strings attached as to how the program is structured. It's sort of a joint federal-state program. And the Republicans want to just create a block grant where the federal government gives the states a set amount of money, and then they decide how to parcel that out, how to spend it, and can sort of construct their own health care program. That would give a lot of freedom to Republicans to experiment with kinds of things that they haven't been able to do, have more premiums, pay-as-you-go, health-based systems, you know, like a penalty if you smoke, for instance. They very much look forward to that. I think that might take a couple of years to roll out, but that's something they're watching for closely.
Right. Now, at least on one issue, I've sensed sort of an evolving two-party system that doesn't involve the Democrats. Two sides of the Republican Party on this transportation issue. Are there any other issues where there might be some fraying within the Republican Party?
Yeah, certainly the road funding is the place where you see it the most, this distinct split, particularly between the Assembly and the Senate, as to whether we should raise the gas tax or find other new source of revenue for roads. Mm-hmm. I think on other issues, we haven't started to see a split on that issue, but you could on there's going to be some gun legislation this time around to allow more concealed carry on college campuses, right, and on K-12 school grounds if you're a permit holder. I think there will be some Republicans who are hesitant to go that far. And, you know, from the more moderate areas, they might get a little queasy about that. So I think you could see some divisions there. And then sometimes on some of the environmental issues, that's somewhere where you could see a split before. Senators like Rob Coles has worked a lot on water issues. You know, depending on what the exact legislation is, how it might affect wetlands is something that he and some other senators and representatives of his ilk might have problems with.
Is that also true, Patrick, on the DNR split, this proposal to break up the DNR essentially, or is there cohesiveness within the party on that?
Well, I don't think we've really come to understand where everybody falls on that.
It's, okay.
The idea certainly is getting more traction than it has in the past. It's been an idea long debated, and Representative Jarkow is sort of heading that up at the moment, and the governor has shown an openness to it. He hasn't embraced it, but he certainly has not ruled it out. We haven't heard a lot from the rest of the caucus as to what they think, and I think we're going to have to see how some hearings go and how that plays out to see how widely it's embraced.
All right, now let's turn to the other party, the Democrats, who are buried about as deep as they've been in as long as I've been following politics in Wisconsin. What can they hope to accomplish with being so deep in the minority?
Well, I mean, there's really very little that they'll have a say on, with the exception of transportation. I think they could have a role there. It could get to a point, even in the Assembly, where they couldn't get some revenue increases without help from the Democrats. Now, the Democrats are going to be, I think, a little cautious about how they want to go on that route. But that is one of the few areas where they might have a say in determining the direction of the state. Otherwise, I mean, Republicans don't need them, and they're not going to listen to them
right,
a lot.
And not likely to seek their counsel. Right. One final question.
And that would be true if the roles were reversed. It's just sort of the nature
that's correct.
Legislative politics.
That's right. That's correct. One final question. This week we learned that Annette Ziegler, a conservative state Supreme Court justice, will not have an opponent. Were Democrats in the state capitol surprised that their own party couldn't recruit someone to run against Ziegler? I know it's a nonpartisan race, but it really has broken conservative liberal. What did you hear in the state capitol?
Well, I think that's the greatest, latest example of just what troubles the Democrats have, that they can't even recruit somebody to run against a seat. Now, Annette Ziegler would be a formidable, will be a formidable opponent. She's done good at fundraising. She's been on the bench for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But to let that opportunity go, there's certainly no way that the left can win if they don't run somebody. Another factor there, though, is that Mike Gabelman is up in a year, and I think many liberals have a particular desire to take him on. And so I think that anybody who may have been thinking of running for the court might rather do it in a year rather than now. Right, but so it's a great example of how in the wilderness Democrats are.
Yeah, so maybe they're keeping their powder dry. Well, we'll talk about that more later. Thanks so much, Patrick Marley in Madison.
If you're a regular listener, you know where that segment comes from. It's from our weekly JS on Politics show. If you haven't subscribed to that yet, you can do so on Audioboom, Stitcher, and iTunes. That does it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Join me next week as I walk you through the biggest stories from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.